Hi and welcome to Last Man Standing. You're here with me, Paul Stevenson, on this Sunday, the 26th of March, 2023. Happy to be with you and I hope you're all well, and please do support RBN. Unfortunately, I don't have all the phone numbers in my head and details, but the best way is just to go to republicbroadcasting.org, Republic Broadcasting Network, and you can see the various donate options available to you. And I think on the right hand side, at the top of the page, you'll see the options there. Anyway, like I said, I'm very glad to be with you here today. This is our clocks go forward or have gone forward. So we've gone into daylight saving hours here finally, because I always find the whole thing where I'm doing a show in the US and then I have to, where you guys, the clocks go forward and then we have to wait a couple of weeks. It all gets a little bit confusing for my small brain, but very glad to be joined tonight with Dr. Patrick Slattery. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Good. Thank you for joining me. So we were talking off air a little bit. Well, I do want to talk to you about Xi Jinping's and the Chinese, how would you call it, diplomatic blitzkrieg recently. They seem to be everywhere, but crucially, they've gone to Russia and they've introduced this peace proposal, which the U.S., I forget his exact title, the U.S. spokesperson John Kirby has immediately shot down and said that that's not in, I forget exactly, but he said it's not in the Ukrainian strategic interests, or was it the U.S.? I don't know. I think probably the Ukrainians. So no peace on the U.S. agenda, at least. But to me, it really signified you know, we talk about these things, but it felt different. It felt that somehow the U.S. didn't really matter. They weren't in the room. It was almost reminding me of when Conor McGregor said, you know, when Conor was at the height of his power in the MMA and he had some little upstart when he was talking, said something, and Conor looked around to him and said, "Who the bleep is that guy?" You know, and completely dismissed him. It's like a kind of an iconic statement of his dismissal of this guy that Conor did in a presser before a fight. And it kind of felt like that. It kind of felt like, you know, when John Kirby in the U.S. came out and said, "We don't recognize this and it's not in the strategic interest of Ukraine at this point, you know, to acknowledge this peace proposal." It almost felt like, who the hell is that guy? Who asked you for your opinion? Do you know what I mean? It just felt that you're not important anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I haven't read thoroughly the Chinese position on the political settlement of the Ukraine crisis. It's got, what is that, 12 headings?
Yes.
Short paragraph for each heading. And it's, you know, it's all kind of boilerplate diplomatic stuff. There's nothing specific about the territorial issue. So they'll say respecting the sovereignty of all countries. Well, all right. So you've got, you could say that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty. You could say it's annexation of, Crimea or, these, other four provinces is a violation. On the other hand, you know, it says respect all countries, big and you know, big and small, strong or weak. The Ukrainian bombardment of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Lugansk People's Republic, they had declared their independence. Is that a violation of their sovereignty? And was the United States sponsored coup, the very much sponsored coup in Ukraine in 2014, that's an violation of their sovereignty? So, I mean, this first one, the respecting the sovereignty of all countries, it's not specific, and you could look at it either way, the, you know, violations. Abandoning the Cold War mentality, that is very much I mean, who has the Cold War mentality? And that's the United States. So that's obviously a slap, whatever. It is a something against the United States. It's a complaint against the United States. And, you know, there's 10 other points. Keeping nuclear power plants safe. Well, who's been shelling nuclear power plants? So, but I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you're going to have a settlement that's based in justice, that's based in international law, it's going to be one that favors Russia. It will, because the Russians were the good guys in this, viewed over the long run.
Yeah. And I think at this stage, you know, it felt to me something different. That's like I said at the preface before I asked the question, because the Russians and the Chinese have gotten together. The Chinese have decided that they're best aligning themselves with Russia, which I agree with, considering the irrationality of the United States and all of this. And I think that if China went to, for example, went to Zelensky and said, listen, we need to stop this fighting. This needs to stop. These are going to be the conditions. They're not going to be perfect for everybody, but, you know, I could probably, you know, I can get Russia to agree to certain things, and that they work out, it might be a case of working out a restructuring of the borders. It might even be Russia giving back that territory. Unlikely, but it could be them giving back that territory under certain conditions of guarantees that the bombardment of the people in that region ceases immediately. Who knows? But the point is, at this stage, and I grew up in Northern Ireland, so I understand this. Wars can't go on forever. You know, after a while, a certain amount of normal people anyway who just want to live their lives, they stop caring who's responsible for it. The wars wear you out, the deaths and the misery and the loss, and it eventually expires itself where people just want peace. So, you know, you have to get back to a situation where this situation stops, because it's an incredible bloodbath. And, you know, Bakhmut, it's just a complete meat grinder. I know it's almost just a figure of speech at this stage, but, you know, it's got to stop. You can't just be angry and pointing fingers at who's to blame and who's not to blame. But the US side have made it clear, for anybody who's got ears to hear on the Ukrainian side or believes that the West cares about the Ukrainian people, they have dismissed it. In other words, they want this fighting to continue. And so what's going to happen eventually? You know, I've been a bit confused about why the US, or sorry, why the Russians have struggled to capture Bakhmut. But I'd say from what I understand, they've left sort of one corridor open there. And the Ukrainians and whoever are the Ukrainian secret police are picking up young men, you know, of teenage age and older men, whatever's left to be scraping the barrel. They're just sending them in there and exhausting whatever Ukrainian forces there are. And if that continues, you know, it's going to be a much easier position that Russia's in after that. And they can then secure Bakhmut. And, you know, how many Ukrainian forces are left? I mean, there's only so many of them can die, you know. And then what?
It seems to me that I'm not a military person. And I don't know exactly what is transpiring, what conversations are being had or being held in the Kremlin. But it seems to me that things are going well for Russia. Last autumn, there was some events that were not taken well by the Russian public and by some of the Russian leadership, when there was these very sudden, abrupt withdrawals from parts of Zaporozhye and Kharkov. There were these abrupt withdrawals, which were, I guess some people in the military thought that they went really well because they withdrew all their material, their equipment, their soldiers with very, very little losses. And the Ukrainians that were following them into the areas or going into the areas that the Russians were evacuating were being blown up. They were being killed. But it was a bad look. It was a retreat. And there was also, at least in some areas, civilian populations that were being left behind to be abused by the incoming Ukrainians, because these were civilian populations that had more or less welcomed the Russians. And then they were subjected to being treated as collaborators by the incoming Ukrainians. That happened in September last year. But overall, it seems like very much time is on Russia's side. And remember, this is not simply a military conflict. It's much more than a military conflict. And in fact, the way I've been describing it all along has been an effort to regime change, overthrow the Russian government, using Ukraine as a sacrificial pawn. Okay, we'll provoke Russia into a war in Ukraine, provoke Russia into invading Ukraine, then
yes,
jump
exactly.
And point at Russia and get the rest of the world to join crippling sanctions that will create demonstrations and financial chaos in Russia and lead the Russians to overthrow the government. But of course, it seems like the opposite is happening, which is why I say everything. It's not just that the military situation, that the Russians aren't losing many soldiers and the Ukrainians are losing huge amounts of soldiers, but the Russian economy is very sound. The Russian society is very stable. But look what's happening in the West. We've got a banking crisis, which does have something to do with this. We've got demonstrations, riots all over France, which is nominally over the pension system, but it has a lot to do with what's going on, the repercussions, the economic and social repercussions from this war. So the Russians are doing very, very well. And I think you'd be hard pressed to tell the people in the Kremlin, hey, you've got to blitzkrieg your way into Kiev in the next month. I don't see why they would think that they're doing anything wrong at this point.
Yeah, and that is exactly what happened. They deliberately provoked Russia to come in there to start this war. And then, as you say, to use the Ukrainian people as a sacrificial lamb in the whole process and as a proxy war against Russia. But as you say, it goes much wider than militarily. I think they underestimated the Russian military as well, and I thought that they could get a fairly quick victory over the Russian military, which didn't materialize, but also, like you say, the sanctions and global and international condemnation that would cause so much suffering in Russia that they would remove Putin. But my worry is at this point, considering this was always the plan of the hubris of the West, and we know there's a small group of people who hate Russia for, you know, more older grudges going back a century. My concern is now that it has all gone wrong. Russia's actually come out of this economically, politically and domestically stronger. The Russian people are behind Putin in a way that they weren't probably behind him before this started. Their military stronger, their ties with China are stronger, and the whole thing's backfiring spectacularly. But these people are not going to go quietly is what I'm concerned about, you know. I mean, for example, when it materializes that it's so obvious that the Russians have, you know, had their way in Ukraine and they've wrecked the place and they control the place, then what happens? Are we going to see the Jewish West just say, okay, well, we lost? I worry about Poland, for example. You know, I mean, are Poland going to get involved with this because I think they might then decide that their best bet is to have a wider conflict, send in the Poles, you know, and start off a wider conflict with, if they need to, at the end of it, they've got the nuclear option. That is my big concern in all this, you know, because I think China and Russia are in such a good position that what happens when the penny drops, you know, really drops.
Well, I don't know, but what you have seen over the past 13 months has been a consolidation of the international community around a Russia-China axis. And this represents a complete backfiring of what you could call the Newland plan. The plan was to galvanize international public opinion against Russia and get all these countries to join in on economic sanctions. And really,
to isolate Russia,
to bring it down. Yeah. And that's just not what happened. First and foremost, because of China. But India is a big deal. India's got as many people as China. They're an incredibly large export market. And so the countries that have participated in the sanctions are the usual suspects. It's the European Union and some of the other fringe European countries, Japan, South Korea, and the rest of the world's not. And the countries that would have formed the non-aligned movement, or that did form the non-aligned movement, they're all going with Russia. And when I say going with Russia, I mean they are not participating in the sanctions. Brazil's not participating in sanctions. Hardly any country in Africa is. I'm not aware of one. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a few that are not really going along with sanctions, but they're not.
No, and you've got these major players basically who are seizing the opportunity to get out from under the yoke of the Western financial hegemony and the U.S. dollars, the world reserve currency, and the petrodollars. And that's what they've accelerated in this. Far from destroying Russia, they're destroying themselves. So that's why I'm worried, because, you know, when it's abundantly clear that, you know, that the new world order that people often talk about is actually quickly becoming the old world order, and the new world order is not what they thought, what are they going to do?
Well, you mentioned that Putin is has more public support than ever, or he's had a big increase in public support. The Russian people are to a very large extent behind Putin, somewhere probably close to 80%, more than 70%. And contrast that to the main Western countries. So Joe Biden is tolerated by, at best, he's tolerated by around half the country. He's supported by much, much less. He really isn't supported. Rishi Sunak, I'm sure he's not particularly popular in Britain.
Recognized by at least half the population as almost the product of a coup.
And Macron, I mean, there's open talk now in France that maybe Macron will have to resign. That's pretty extreme. Western leaders are just not popular. They don't have public support. The Western economies are doing very badly. So you've got these three banks that have failed in the United States, the Silicon Valley Bank being the most famous and the largest of them, but Credit Suisse in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Deutsche Bank in Germany is in big trouble.
Yeah. The whole thing's a house of cards in the West, politically, economically, culturally, and it's the opposite of that in Russia. Olaf Scholz, have you ever seen this guy? He looks like a deer in the headlights constantly. He looks like a little boy. There still hasn't been any kind of anti-US rhetoric coming from the Germans over Nord Stream. Nothing. I mean, they're just blowing up your pipeline. It's going to destroy German industry. And this guy says nothing. There's not even an investigation into it. There isn't any kind of discussion that I'm aware of. Just silence.
Yeah, and I mean, that real. Sometimes people talk about blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline as an act of terrorism. It's not an act of terrorism. It's an act of war. It's an act of war not just against Russia. It's an act of war against Germany.
Of course.
Terrorism is when you conduct random violence, random acts of violence in order to intimidate the greater population, because maybe they might be the next random victim, so they feel terrorized. That's what terrorism is. It's what they did with Nord Stream. Nobody is terrorized that the sewer pipes going into their house are going to be similarly blown up. They're not afraid of random violence. But everybody was impacted by the loss of energy, by the resulting spike in energy prices. I guess it wasn't such a cold winter, so maybe not very many people froze to death. But that was an act of war, not an act of terrorism. And it was an act of war against Germany in addition to against Russia.
Yeah, and typically you usually attribute acts of terrorism to paramilitary groups, whether it's some sort of jihadi paramilitary group. But this was an act of international vandalism and an act of war that could only be carried out by a handful of states. But anyway, the point is the Germans, in terms of their leadership, have not pushed back. There hasn't been any outrage. I know from reading certain articles in the German press, of course, there's a lot of frustration in Germany, over this act alone. They recognize that this has been a mild winter. Also, they've had, to some extent, have some reserves that have allowed them to suffer less this winter. But next year is when it's going to really bite. So it's only going to get worse for the West. And, while I am irritated every time I look on YouTube or Odyssey seeing about the financial collapse is imminent, I understand that it is actually on its way. I just get sick of watching these thumbnails all the time saying that it's going to happen tomorrow morning. It may do, but it's coming. When exactly, we don't know. I mean, you've had the Silicon Valley Bank. You mentioned Credit Suisse over here. There was another bank in New York, I believe, failed as well, if I'm correct.
The First Republic Bank, which I'm not sure where that's located, and there's one called Signature Bank in New York.
Right,
a couple of years ago closed down Donald Trump's accounts because he's a bad man. He's a bad man. They're a good bank. They're a good bank with good people.
Yeah, so it is coming anyway. Whether it's next week, or whether it's next year, or somehow they can, keep this whole scam going for another few years, I don't know. I mean, I'm surprised they've been able to keep it going this long, but, the writing's on the wall. So Europe's really not in a good position. And it's back to that question. What are they going to do? Because to some extent, and again, if certain military guys, like you, I'm not a military person, and I, even if I read articles, because of my limited knowledge, it's hard for me to decipher truth from fiction in these things. But, according to people like Douglas McGregor and et al, that the West is not in good shape militarily. So I wonder what would happen, if Poland did go into Ukraine, for example. It got so desperate there that the Poles and a coalition of the willing, as it's described in brackets, code language for NATO as an organization's not interested. If they did go in there, of course you would see all sorts of sensational news outlets covering that World War III had started. But okay, World War III sounds like a scary thing. And I think typically in our minds, we think it would be a scary thing. But in reality, on the ground, yeah, conceivably the Poles could go in there with a coalition of the willing. The Russians would wipe them out, and that would be the end of that, you know? And the NATO countries are saying, no, thank you. We've no interest in that. And, you know, so I think either way, in a conventional fashion, what the US and what NATO have to offer in terms of a resistance against Russia and their allies, I don't think it's particularly impressive, if certain people are to be believed. And therefore, it would just be a continuation of what we're seeing in Ukraine today. Of course, the scary thing is if they start, you know, the draft, and you have this expansion of the meat grinder, and, you know, you just have young people and, you know, people who are not fit for purpose being sent in to fight in this war, you know, being just like lambs sent to the slaughter, or nuclear weapons. And, you know, if it wasn't for Jews in the West, I don't think nuclear weapons is something I'd even worry about. But I do, because these people are crazy, you know? And I wonder, does Vladimir Putin understand how crazy they are, you know?
I have the feeling he has a high level of understanding, but he doesn't mention them. And I want to get to that in a second. Regarding the Poles, I mean, if the Poles were to do something like you suggested, it would really be proving that there was something after all to all of those Polish jokes. But I don't think there really is anything to those Polish jokes. I think that's simply a reflection of Jewish animosity towards Poles. And so I'm not really expecting the Poles to do anything like that. But one thing that I do want to mention, something we were talking about briefly before the show, is people really got to get over World War II. They got to get over the Nazis and all of this. You mentioned Douglas McGregor, who he hasn't said anything that I find particular fault with. Scott Ritter, I've met Scott Ritter before. He seems like a decent guy, but I didn't hear it personally, but David Duke was telling me he heard one of Scott Ritter's recent appearances on somebody's podcast where he was saying, talking about the Ukrainian Nazis, because Scott Ritter's on more or less, for the most part, on the right side of this. Every now and then he I guess for a while last year, he thought all was lost for Russia. I don't know why, but he went on. He was very black-pilled on the war situation for a couple of weeks. But in general, you know, he has been taking the Russian side. But part of what he says is the Ukrainians, he's against the Ukrainians because they're Nazis, that the Azov battalion, the Nazis run Ukraine. He won't mention the fact that the actual leadership of Ukraine from the president on down is chock full of Jews.
Yeah, but they're funded by a guy called Kolomoisky.
Yeah, they're Nazis, and he doesn't care if the Nazis die. He wants them all to die. And you hear this from Scott Ritter. You hear this type of thing from Alex Jones. And really, our people, we have to get over this. I don't care if you don't have to go full Kanye West and say you love Hitler. But really, the idea that World War II was somehow a big, you know, worldwide fight between good and evil and good prevailed, it, you know, that at a minimum, that is just nonsense. Certainly, the Axis powers had legitimate grievances. You can certainly say that. And you can also certainly say that the Allies, in the pursuit of their war aims, well, they nuked and firebombed cities full of civilians. So they're certainly not purely the forces of good. So people have to get over this. And in not just World War II, but in general, you see in the United States, you'll see conservatives or white people, you know, they'll never, like Tucker Carlson or the people he has on his show, when they're criticizing the anti-white rhetoric from the you know Jewish led radicals, they will compare the enemies of white people with the segregationists of the South. So here's the thing, whether you're talking about Nazis, whether you're talking about segregationists of the South or whatever, the bad guys in these stories were white people, right? So why do you have to wrap yourself in these clothing? Why do you have to cling to the enemies of your enemies and cling to the heroes of your enemies and cling to that? Why do you have to promote promote Martin Luther King? You know, you can just leave that well enough alone. If you don't want to talk about it, don't talk about it. But
yeah, because so much of it was an artificial construct that we've got to get away from, because it's not playing into our interests, I think is what you're trying to say, or what you have said. I think, well, I've just said as part of it. But Scott Ritter, I really don't appreciate when he goes on an anti-Bandera rant and that he doesn't care about the slaughter of these young guys and then Azov Battalion or whatever. Well, they're still human beings, and I imagine it's not just a bunch of neo-Nazis in there as they're described. I imagine it's a mixture of CIA operatives, some really brainwashed kids who've had a lot of suffering and have decided to vent their anger. And like you say, it's not helpful. You know, if this was such a threat, you wouldn't have Kolomoisky funding the whole operation. It's obviously playing into their interest, and I wish he'd shut his mouth about that, because I think generally he is on the right side of the arguments when it comes to all this. But yeah, we spoke about, I remember one of the early shows we did, you know, asking, does it, you know, is it helpful for us to discuss a certain German leader in the 1930s? You know, we've got to get away from it, because I don't think it's helping our cause. You know, a lot of the narrative round of it, and you mentioned Tucker Carlson and some of the things that you alluded to, you know, these are all symptomatic of, they are so saturated in their foundations of Jewish lies, you know, and that whole narrative that came out of World War II that we're all having a hangover from, and that, and largely it has little or no relevance to our lives in 2023 or our interests in 2023 or what's happening in Ukraine, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have to get over it. It's
yes.
I mean, there can be relevance, but the relevance is usually not in the least bit accurately reflected by the rhetoric that they use. And it's unfortunate. I wish Vladimir Putin wouldn't be talking about the denazification of Ukraine, because yes, there are people in Ukraine, you know, the Azov Battalion and whatnot, who embrace Nazi symbols and whatnot. But you know, on two things. One is they don't run Ukraine. Ukraine is run by this Jewish elite, by a Jewish president, by Jewish oligarchs.
Yeah.
So they don't run Ukraine. And then the second thing is the way that Germany, World War II era Germany, is viewed in Eastern Europe is very different from the way it's viewed here, because there was a very different context. The context in Eastern Europe was, to a large extent, in the 1920s and the 1930s, Jews had acquired a huge amount of power in some countries, of Russia in particular. They had taken over the country. In other places, they had attempted takeovers that were short-lived or that were unsuccessful. But people in Eastern Europe had every reason, based on their recent life experiences, to be very alarmed at Jewish power. And for the people in the Ukraine, having gone through maybe the worst of it with the Holodomor, it's very understandable that some of the people in the Ukraine would have welcomed a German invasion, at least initially, would have welcomed them as liberators, and that there would still be lingering sentiment in favor of Nazi Germany. That's actually understandable.
Yes.
And it's hard to explain this to people, but they don't. But then, of course, a lot of them have a very unsophisticated relationship with it. And they get, you know, the swastika tattooed on their scalps and shave their head and weird things like that. So they're just because somebody has a swastika tattoo doesn't necessarily make them the good guy either. But, you know, these things are kind of understandable, and we want to be able to understand things.
Yeah, I was going to say the more dangerous narrative is this idea that Russia is still the Soviet Union, because whether they believe this or not, or they're pretending to, but, you know, you have leadership in the ex-communist countries that believe this narrative and are getting, you know, paranoid, you know, that Russia's ready to invade them. And they're, you know, you're hearing moves in these countries, particularly, that they're going to be increasing their military budgets, because they'll be on the front line. So, you know, this narrative essentially is that Russia, once they're finished with Ukraine, they're coming gradually into, you know, the ex-communist countries, and Poland's going to get it, et cetera, et cetera. And that will be the narrative. If you have Poles that go into Ukraine, and then you have Russia starting to send missiles and respond to that in Warsaw or wherever in Poland, everyone will say, look, see, we told you. All you people said Russia had no interest in going into any other country. It was just a Ukrainian issue. Well, now you've got egg in your face because you've been wrong. This is what I mean. It's like these ex-communist countries are a problem, because if they believe this narrative and they get paranoid, I mean, you can lash out when you're paranoid, and you can bring about your own worst fears, you know? It's like my grandfather used to say. He said, when you're scared, you'll see ghosts. And I think there is a large, you know, percentage of those in those countries that have a certain, you know, that they're seeing ghosts all the time, and that they have this hangover from the Soviet era that the Soviets are coming again for them, you know? And I mean, like you say, there's a lot of people don't have a very sophisticated view of this. And it seems to be all nigh on impossible to explain to people that Russia is not the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union collapsed, you know?
Well, so this was one of the problems of bringing these countries into NATO.
Yeah.
There may have been people who thought, oh, you know, we beat the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And wow, now we've got Poland in NATO, and we've got Romania in NATO, and Estonia and Lithuania and Latvia. Let's bring in Ukraine. It shows that we're the good guys. Everybody wants to be with us. And how does it make the United States or other founding countries in NATO, like Britain, how does it improve our position at all, the people who live here at all, to bring in these Eastern European countries that have grievances against Russia that have nothing to do with us? They're not in our interest, but they've got historical grievances against Russia, and now and are likely to provoke Russia the way Ukraine has been doing, the way Poland potentially could. How does it make us any more secure by promising by treaty to come to their defense should they go to blows with Russia? It doesn't make us stronger. It's very much to our detriment. All along the way, it's been to our detriment. This whole alliance system is very much to our detriment. And
well,
we've got to get over it.
I think it's not by accident that those countries in Eastern Europe were encouraged, let's say, by those who run the West to come into NATO, because NATO was supposed to be seen as a defensive alliance and to stop the European nations squabbling, essentially, so that they're not going to be fighting among themselves. But for the Jewish West, it was seen as just what you described, you know, an organized, united weapon against a particularly a paranoid Eastern Europe to be used against Russia. Well, that's my take on it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So something that we've definitely got to get over. Well, I want to ask you though, being in the neighborhood, what do you think is going to go on? What do you think is going to result from these massive riots that they're having in France?
Well, I hope that Macron is forced to resign, and you see something, you know, come in there in France, which is more akin and consistent with the interests of the French people. Because again, I don't think the vast majority of the French people want any part in this provocation against against Russia, for example. Or probably a significant percentage of the German population, for example, because there's too many problems at home. All things being equal, most people are decent and they don't want this war to continue because they realize that it's a lot of suffering and death and misery for the Ukrainian people, but people have got their own interests. You know, they want to put fuel in their cars, they want to heat their homes, they want to be able to, feed their families. So the problem is that this constant blind support for the Ukraine, it doesn't represent the interests of the West, of the European peoples. And I think that you're going to have to see some changes here in leadership. I mean, you can't be having this guy Scholz in Germany for too much longer, for example. Over here, it's a little bit more difficult because it's like in the United States, we've got a two-party system, which seems nigh on impossible. I mean, it's ironic how we constantly talk about democracy, but we've got this system, which is a uni-party, is that a word? It's a one-party system. I mean, when it came to COVID, they're on the same page. When it comes to foreign policy, they're on the same page. There's no difference. There's no representation of the people. So then occasionally what you have in countries like this is you have dog whistlers who come into politics, who promise the world, and then when they get in there, they just do the same thing. They do the opposite of what the people elected them to come in there. But I think we're going to have to see some changes in leadership and representation in the West, and hopefully the French will actually force this clown out. I mean, even if it has to be like even if it has to be a sort of on a mass aggression scale where the country is just not functioning. Where he almost like, was it Sri Lanka? Where he's got no choice but to go, that the whole thing's breaking down. And the French don't need that much to be rioting about, but the riots they've had over the weekends have been staggering,
They've been staggering, honestly. And I know it's not just about the pension system, that's maybe the proximate cause. But there's a lot of anger that has to do with all sorts of things. There was even before COVID, you had the yellow vests. There's all this immigration. They might not feel comfortable rioting over immigration, but they might. A lot of that immigration frustration can be vented in. Riots or demonstrations about other things. And then, of course, they've been subjected to all the COVID lockdowns and to the economic hardships having to do with the war in Ukraine. And so it's interesting. I mean, just the strictly the pension issue, I don't even know if I really agree with that. But whatever, I support them going out and raising some hell because the situation's all over the West is unbearable. But, strictly speaking regarding the pension issue, I don't even know if I agree with them, but, let them have at it. That's what I say. I don't know if there's in any countries, if there's really anybody, poised to take over and, lead in the right way. I don't know if there's anybody with like what the alternatives is.
I suppose
In Italy, maybe Berlusconi and Matteo could represent an improvement, But I mean, who is waiting in the wings in Britain?
You have people, nobody really, but I mean, if you had a proper, you know, if you had some proper representation, instead of this, you know, locked in two-party system, which is, it makes it almost impossible to break down. You might see Nigel Farage, you know, do something. You might see Patriotic Alternative maybe do something 5 or 10 years from now. Who knows? But it's like impossible to break down, to break through that system. And, you know, people got excited about Maloney, you know, but, again, these people say the right things. When they're on the right side of the culture war, they're always supporters of Israel, for example. They're always supporters of a lot of these international ideas when it comes to it. But they say the right things to get in there. But Maloney wasn't in there 5 minutes and before she was saying, we stand by Ukraine, you know?
But she had always said she was pro-Ukrainian even before she became prime minister. She's backing down on the migration issue, right? She just wants migration to be safe and legal.
But this is what I mean, you know. They say the right things to get in, and then they buckle. They, you know, they don't have the courage of their convictions. You know, you saw the same thing with Trump, and they say a lot of great things. He's going to drain the swamp, and sorry, you just surrounded yourself by the swamp. And every time you came under any pressure, you buckled. I mean, he was better than what we have, obviously, but that wouldn't be hard. Listen, it doesn't have to happen next week or next year, but it has to happen. And I think, you know, there's going to be more misery yet to come before it does happen. But changes need to happen in terms of the, you know, leadership and who's representing the European people, because it's untenable that what you have at the minute is you have not only leaders who don't represent the interests of the people and the people who voted them in there, but they're actually acting diametrically opposed to them, and, you know, diametrically opposed to the campaign policies that they ran on. You know, you see it time and time again, you know.
Anyway, I see what's going on now is actually, when I say what's going on now, I think there's a lot to feel hopeful about. Not that anything's a sure thing, but compared to what we've been going through for the past several years, if you looked just at what's been going on in our own countries for the past several years, and you could look at Trump's election, you could look at the Brexit vote, and then you could look at what's happened since then for us, you know, lockdowns and riots and
inflation,
and the war with Ukraine and everything It just seems like this is the exact opposite of the types of things we were voted for. So we vote for something, and then what do we get? We get the exact opposite. And people don't seem to know what to do. And so on the one hand, I really don't think, I'm pretty skeptical about our ability to turn things around ourselves. On the other hand, I'm becoming more optimistic about the system collapsing from its own weight without being pushed from within by us.
Yeah.
I think that this, the war with, the proxy war with Russia in Ukraine, was probably the straw that's going to break the camel's back. And that's what future historians are probably already talking about. It's triggered a realignment of international politics where the United States is no longer at the center, and the United States is no longer in a position to call the shots, where the Bretton Woods system, economic system, has just been completely it's been made irrelevant, and you're having alternative systems being built up. And I'm hopeful that the system is going to collapse, not because of the actions from within, but because of the actions from without, from outside. Yeah.
And the irony is they brought it about themselves, you know. And I remember speaking about that last year, thinking, I mean, are these people insane? I mean, they're cutting their own throats. But, you know, sometimes you can just bite off more than you can chew, and your hubris will get you in trouble, you know? And that's what you're seeing. I just still worry, though, that, you know, a dying vampire doesn't die easily. It's usually very messy and smelly and disgusting in these, when you watch it in the movies. And I think that's what you're having. You're having a dying parasite who's had a stake put through his heart and is in the process of having a stake put through his heart, and that they're not going to go quietly. I've always feared that, you know, and I still fear that, because I think that these people are crazy enough to do that. And these people should not be, not only in public office, they should not be walking the streets, you know. These people are insane.
My position is, like, even though you could, I've been calling Victoria Nuland the most dangerous person on earth for many years now. It's not as if I want to, I mean, and you could certainly make the case that she should go to prison for the rest of her life, but that's not what I'm seeking. I just want to remove her from any kind of decision making. And then we can let whatever powers that be in the afterlife or whatever deal with her. But she and the many, many other people of her ilk just need to be removed from power and never let back in.
Yes, and we're almost there, and I can only agree with that in the strongest terms, because Nuland and her ilk, and, you know, I don't think there's that many of them. They do need to be removed because they are a menace. And I think a lot of this stuff can be resolved if it wasn't for the Nulands of this world. So let's hope that some, you know, mature heads and adults in the room will recognize this and you know, remove these people, because it's just untenable. It's intolerable. Patrick, thank you very much for joining me. I'll be back here again next week on Last Man Standing. That is, what day is that? Probably the 2nd or 3rd of April. So until then, take care and God bless.